Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too would like to express my appreciation to the organizers of this symposium for the privilege of joining and paying tribute to Frank Parker. His leadership and legacy are really outstanding. As we attempt to look ahead, it's usually helpful to turn back and examine where we've been and how we got to where we are now. If we do so, we go back to the beginning of the radiation era. People were essentially unaware of the hazards at the time. The radiologist and his associate took no precautions to shield any part of the body, often focusing on the bones of their own hands and fingers. And in that practice, next please, giving rise to serious injuries ultimately of the hands, radiation dermatitis, and ultimately radiation-induced cancer. Many of the early pioneers succumbed to this fate. Next, please. Other early martyrs to radiation-induced cancer were the women who were employed painting radium dials. They would point their camel's hair brushes between their lips, and this way gradually ingesting toxic quantities of radium, which homed to the skeleton and led to bone tumors. In those days, it used to be taken for granted that it took a large dose to cause cancer. Next, please. And it came as somewhat of a shock to discover within just a few years, within 5 years after the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this epidemic of leukemia arising in the heavily irradiated survivors. Approximately irradiated survivors within 5 years showed a rise in the incidence of leukemia, which was not evident in those more distally exposed. Next, please. And then the real shocker came some years later when Ed Lewis, a geneticist at Caltech, noticed that among ABOM survivors, patients treated with radiation therapy to the spine for ankylosing spondylitis, and even radiologists who accumulated their doses gradually over years, showed an incidence of leukemia not terribly different. And Lewis knew at the time that mutations were assumed to be proportional to dose, and he suspected that leukemia might then be a mutation. And if so, the relationship should be linear, non-threshold, all the way down to zero dose, and maybe 10% of all leukemias in the general population could be attributable to natural background. This was a very disturbing idea. Austin Bruce at the Argonne Laboratory pointed out that the data really don't prove linearity. They don't exclude the possibility of a threshold. And the debate has raged ever since. What is the shape of this dose response curve? Next, please. The latest evidence out of Japan shows this kind of a relationship, compatible with a linear quadratic, next please, linear quadratic function, which is what one would expect for a chromosomal aberration. Next, please. Consistent with this interpretation is the fact that when one looks at radiation workers in different groups, pools the data, one gets an excess of leukemia comparable to what one would predict from the Japanese data. There's a lot of variation among the groups, but the pool data support the interpretation of a linear non-threshold dose response. Next, please. And leukemia is not the only cancer increased in frequency among the ABOM survivors. Many, but not all, cancers show this dose-dependent increase in frequency. Next, please. And if one pools all the data for the solid cancers, leukemia excluded, one sees what is consistent with the linear response. Not a hockey stick-shaped curve. Next, please. And Mendelsohn has pointed out that for solid cancers in the ABOM survivors, the data for cancer are consistent with the data for somatic mutations. Whereas for leukemia, the dose response data look like those you see for chromosome aberration induction in the same population. makes ecological and epidemiological sense. Next, please. Seen in the light of the fact that cancers typically evolve through a series of genetic alterations, these are data for colon cancer, published by Fearon and Vogelstein of Hopkins, not just one chromosomal abnormality, but a succession of changes, next please, led Mendelssohn to postulate that in the ABOM survivors, one is dealing with the development of cancer as a multi-mutational disease. The mutations occur spontaneously as one grows older. Radiation simply imposes on the process an additional one or two mutational events. Next, please. I remember vividly when I was at Oak Ridge back in the 50s, Bill Russell and his colleagues found that chronic exposure to low LET radiation, gamma rays, was less mutagenic than acute exposure. These are mutations in mouse spermatogonia. This was a revolutionary idea. Experiments in the fruit fly had shown there was no dose rate effect. Here, clearly, several fold less mutagenic if radiation is given chronically than acutely. Next, please. In those days, it was thought that this related to the density of ionizations across the chromosome. With densely ionizing or high-frequency radiation, one is producing more change in the chromosome fiber, locally multi-site lesions that are less reparable or error-prone repair. Next, please. Since then, a whole series of adaptive responses have come into play. These involve a variety of metabolic effects on cells, and some have interpreted these to mean that small doses are actually beneficial, so-called radiation hormesis. Radiation stimulates reparative processes that make the organism better than ever. Next, please. Actually, the data on mutations show that below a certain dose rate, radiation becomes more mutagenic again, as though the reparative processes require a certain level of exposure be optimally stimulated and activated. So it's not at all clear that the hormesis idea is in fact tenable. Only further research will establish. Next, please. And there are a whole variety of effects now that complicate interpretation of dose-effect relationship. Radiation of one cell can cause, through gap junction cell-cell communication, changes in a neighboring cell, including DNA damage, mutations, if you will. So you don't have to hit the chromosome directly or even hit the cell directly. You can damage its neighbor and produce these changes. So we now see, I think, a variety of very revealing molecular biological investigations that will help us ultimately understand what's going on and better monitor and measure risks. Next, please. So we really don't know yet precisely what the shape of the curve is in the low-dose domain. There are arguments going on all the time, and further studies will be necessary to resolve the issue. Next, please. So what do we do about low-level radiation? What are the risks? Next. We can relate different kinds of exposures to different doses. Next, please. And efforts have been made to determine, as best we can with existing knowledge, what the risks may be. Looking at natural background radiation and the kinds of mutational changes that can be transmitted from one generation to the next, it looks as though natural background contributes only a vanishingly small fraction to the total genetic burden, which is reassuring. Next, please. If we look at carcinogenic effects, only a very small fraction of the total natural burden is attributable to natural background radiation. Radiation workers, on the other hand, have an appreciable contribution if they get 50 millisieverts per year throughout a lifetime. Next, please. And this prompted the National Radiology Protection, NCRP, and the International Commission to recommend that not 5 millisieverts a year, but if one is exposed annually over a working lifetime, a much lower average. Next, please. And given what we know, it would appear that the average dose to radiation workers does not push them out of the safe range. The index of harm, all things considered, to radiation workers puts them within the same range as those employed in other safe, so-called safe industries. Next, please. Well, so much for averages. There are certain genetic traits that make people more sensitive to radiation, like this little girl with basal cell nevus syndrome. She was born with a brain tumor, a meningioma, and received radiation therapy to the base of her skull. Within 6 months, developed a crop of basal cell carcinomas at the margins of the treatment field. Exquisitely sensitive to carcinogenic effects of radiation. Next, please. And we know now of a number of diseases, many associated with defects in DNA repair that predispose to radiation injury. And there are other kinds of metabolic lesions that predispose to other forms of carcinogenic insult. So this, again, is another area of research that's unfolding rather rapidly today, giving us pause as we generalize about risks to individuals as opposed to populations. As we learn more about the nature of the carcinogenic process, it's going to be feasible to intervene more effectively at various stages. Next, please. This calls to mind another episode in my lifetime that I find very revealing. I can vividly recall in 1960 when Noel and Hungerford described the Philadelphia chromosome. Patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia usually had a tiny chromosome, a small chromosome number 22. It wasn't clear in the beginning whether this was the result of leukemia or somehow related to the cause. And then it was found that patients with this chromosome who didn't have leukemia, when followed over time, developed leukemia later. It was postulated at the time then that this must represent the deletion of some critical information in chromosome 22 that allowed the cell to escape normal controls. But then, some years later, Janet Rowley at the University of Chicago pointed out that this small chromosome wasn't the whole story, that there was a translocation. And the translocation brought into position, it was turned out later, the Abelson oncogene and a promoter. And this combination prompted the neoplastic growth of the cell. It was then shown, 30 years after the discovery of the Philadelphia chromosome, that it was this particular product of the translocation that caused the leukemia. And a decade later, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, was found to be effective in the treatment of the disease. So here we have a succession of findings over a period of 40 years that allowed the development of a therapy without side effects that was curative, essentially. And I think we'll see this go again and again. It's happening before our eyes. It may well turn out in 1,000 years that cancer is no longer a scourge, We know how to deal with it, know how to prevent it, know how to treat it. Next, please. So finally, where do we stand as we try to look 1,000 years into the future? What we see is that over the past century, there have been repeated efforts to lower limits as we learn more and more about radiation injury. And at the present, the recommended limits are based on the supposition, the hypothesis, that there isn't any totally safe dose. That any dose may involve some element of risk, a non-threshold dose-effect relationship. However, there are now a growing number of findings that point to reparative processes that are elicited by radiation in the low to intermediate dose range. And the extent to which these really prevent the extrapolation into the very low dose range still remains to be determined. Only further research incorporating and integrating approaches at the epidemiological, cellular, and molecular levels will resolve these issues. The issues of repair, the issues of hypersensitivity among certain members of the population. So that in the meantime, I think we can infer reasonably safely that any risks to members of the population that may result from exposure within the current dose limits are likely to be undetectable. I won't say hypothetical, but certainly small enough to be undetectable. And I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much.